It's an easy way to start a debate. Get in a room full of parents and state your position on vaccines, whatever it is, loudly and forcefully. Vaccines are the subject of many a debate right now. What was once routine is now undergoing a great deal of scrutiny. Our next guests maintain the scrutiny in a book called The Vaccine Friendly Plan. It's a sunny book with pictures of healthy kids on the cover, and as you'll hear, it's less about whether to vaccinate than when. Dr. Paul Thomas is an MD, board certified in pediatrics. He practices at Integrative Pediatrics in Portland and has 10 children of his own, all grown, all vaccinated. Welcome, Dr. Thomas.
Thanks, Jeff. It's good to be here.
Jennifer Margulis is a voice known to Jefferson Exchange listeners. She's a science journalist with a number of books and articles to her credit, including work published in major newspapers and Smithsonian, and she is also an occasional contributor to JPR News. Jennifer, good to have you in the studio again.
Thanks for having me.
So can I guess that the two of you met through Jennifer's research?
We met actually last year when the Senate Bill 442 was being looked at by the Senate Committee, the Health Committee, and I closed my practice, went down to testify to that committee, and Jennifer did the same. You drove up from Ashland.
This is a state Senate bill we're talking about.
So that was a state Senate bill like the one in California that proposed to do away with exemptions to vaccines. So basically get all kids vaccinated, bar kids from school if they hadn't had all of the vaccines on the schedule. So they were trying to bar kids from public school, private school, and even from daycare. And although both Paul and I are pro-vaccine, we thought that that was not an appropriate bill to be passed into law. We didn't think that that would help the children of Oregon.
All right, Paul, in the book, you identify yourself as vaccine friendly. So this is not a book about not having vaccines. It's a lot more, it seems like, about timing then.
Timing is very critical. As we point out in our first chapter, toxins, toxins, toxins. You know, the children in America today are really struggling with chronic illnesses. And it's very important that we start paying attention to why. And toxins is a big piece of that puzzle. And so some of the vaccines, it's very clear that our listeners understand the toxins are all over the place. We have acetaminophen is a bad toxin that amplifies other toxins. We have pesticides and herbicides, aspartame, and of course in vaccines, the multi-dose flu shot has mercury and many vaccines have aluminum, both of which are known to be neurotoxic and hard on a developing brain.
Your own motivation though for advocating for vaccines generally, though. I mean, apparently in your life, you've seen kids die of diseases that we have vaccines for.
Absolutely. When I was growing up, one of my friends and playmates, who was almost like a brother to me, Taurai, got measles and died very quickly. And, of course, many of my friends and myself, we did get measles and survived it just fine. But I became aware that once I learned he had died of measles, it's like, wow, I wonder if he might have been spared had we done the MMR or the measles vaccine.
All right, so you do again. So both of you guys are pro-vaccine, but there are places where you part, in particular, from the recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP. What are those points?
So let's clarify the pro-vaccine. I'm pro-antibiotics, and I'm pro-vaccine. But in certain situations, you might say I'm anti-antibiotics, and in certain situations, you might say I'm anti-vaccine, because it shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all. Right? Antibiotics are wonderful and they've saved millions of lives, and yet we overuse them. And I think most people, most of your listeners are aware of that. Well, vaccines is no different. The simplest one to explain that most people can understand is hepatitis B vaccine. So when I was going to medical school, I was given that vaccine because I might be exposed to blood products. My children, who are now in their 20s, got that vaccine when they were teenagers. But about 15 to 20 years ago, across the country, the CDC and the Academy of Pediatrics made the decision to move that vaccine from teenagers to newborns. We were told, well, this would be a good idea because it's hard to get teenagers in to get a series of vaccines. True. And we'll develop a population that's immune to hepatitis B. Sounded like a good idea. So we did that, and we've been doing that for the last 15 to 20 years. What we now know, and there have been several studies that are showing this, it's not giving lasting protection. So the plan was to have a population that grew up protected, but 20-year-olds today who got the series as infants, the latest study showed only 24% of them still had protection. So therefore, vaccinating infants with that vaccine is going to result in a population at greater risk exactly when they need the protection. So remember, hepatitis B is something you catch from sex and IV drug use. I sort of tease with my parents, I don't think your baby's going to be at risk of that. Now, 1 out of 100, according to the CDC data, moms who are pregnant have hepatitis B. In my experience, it's much lower than that. But that 1 out of 100 child born to a mother who has hepatitis B should get the vaccine. So here's a situation where, yes, I'm pro-hepatitis B vaccine for that infant, but for 99 out of 100, it's a very bad idea, and I'll tell you why. That vaccine has 250 micrograms of aluminum. Aluminum's a known neurotoxin. We have a study by Bishop in 1999 that says don't exceed 5 micrograms per kilogram. The FDA has a document that's live, don't exceed 5 micrograms per kilogram or you cause neurotoxicity. A newborn weighs, let's say, 8 to 10 pounds, 4 to 5 kilos. 5 times 5 is 25. We should not exceed 25 micrograms of aluminum, but we're injecting 250. So there's my challenge with the one-size-fits-all.
Why are things like aluminum and mercury present in vaccines in the first place? And I'm sure, I know I'm not the only person to ask this before, but it seems like it took a lot longer to get them out than it took to get them in.
Right. Perfect question. The aluminum was placed back in the 40s and 50s when they were developing vaccines as an adjuvant. Fancy term to mean it stimulates the immune system. And basically the way it does that is it causes a lot of inflammation at the site. You know, when
so
you
it's
get
meant
a,
to irritate everybody.
Exactly.
The immune system rises the response.
Creates a bunch of blood flow. That way your immune system interacts with the antigen, which is the thing you're trying to vaccinate against. Mercury is placed in those multi-dose vials as a preservative so that fungus, multi-dose vials like the flu shot that's multi-dose, you're going to go into that vial 10 times, pull off 10 different vaccines from the same bottle. Each time you inject, you could put in a spore, fungal spore, and so it's put in there to prevent those spores from being able to generate and then cause problems for another person who then gets a dose taken out of that vial.
So it's put in there as poison. It's meant to keep the fungus poisoned.
You could put it that way, I guess.
I just did. We will come back and talk more with Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis about the vaccine-friendly plan back on the Jefferson Exchange with the two of them and with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about vaccines for children in ways that will help prevent them getting horrible diseases that the world has known. It's not so much a question of whether in the eyes of Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis, but when. They have co-written a book called The Vaccine Friendly Plan. He is a pediatrician. She is a science journalist. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Thomas, you were talking about the switch to getting the hepatitis B vaccine into newborns because the concern was that you wouldn't be able to catch them as teens. Which raises a question then, if it's all just about when you can see a baby, is the determination to get a lot of vaccines into children when they are very young partly because you can't guarantee getting them back to a doctor's office after 1 year or so?
That's often quoted as a reason, but frankly, I think that's a fairly lame excuse for doing something the wrong way. I should point out to our listeners that certain vaccines, like the Tdap, the DPT, which covers whooping cough, pertussis, is given at 2 months, again at 4 months, again at 6 months, and then a booster at 18 months and 4 years of age. You might ask, well, why so often? The reason is that disease, whooping cough, is very dangerous the younger you are. In fact, most deaths in America, and there are about 5 to 10 a year out of the 4 million births, are in 3-month-olds or younger. So for that reason, if we wait and vaccinate when they're a year or two old, we've pretty much missed the major risk period. However, when we give a vaccine at 2 months, that protection is not great because their immune system is so immature. So we do a booster, and then we do another booster just to sort of amplify their immune response against that organism.
Over the course of your medical career, has the number and approach to vaccines changed?
Very much so. So we have a table in our book that shows the number of vaccines back in 1983 compared to this past year. And those numbers have gone up from, I believe it was 12 or 13 to almost 60 different vaccines. But probably even more concerning is the compression of the vaccine schedule into infants whose immune system is really not designed to handle that sort of an immune challenge. And what that's resulted in, sort of inadvertently and not talked about very much, is a shift in the immune system from that of fighting infection to that of the allergic state.
Put this to Jennifer Margulis as the science journalist here, because you probably dug into this. How much research has gone on into the effects of vaccine in combination?
That's an excellent question. One of the problems with the current CDC vaccine schedule is that vaccines are tested, and they're exhaustively safety tested before they go to market, but only one vaccine is tested at a time. There has never been carefully done scientific studies to show what happens when you put vaccines together. So earlier, Dr. Thomas was talking about the aluminum in the hepatitis B vaccine. At birth, that's the only vaccine that we give to newborns. But then at 2 months, we give a series of shots, and several of those shots contain aluminum. One of our recommendations, our evidence-based scientific recommendations, is to ask parents to space out those aluminum-containing shots. We have concerns about aluminum as a neurotoxin, and obviously we need the aluminum to make the vaccines work, as Dr. Thomas was explaining, but if we just do one at a time, we have a less opportunity of overloading a child's immune system. And, you know, literally, these combinations, when we're giving lots and lots of vaccines, so many vaccines to such a young immune system, we have not studied, carefully, scientifically studied the effects.
Which raises a question from John in Ashland, sent in by email. He says, an objective review of vaccine studies shows they are safe and extremely beneficial for the general public by any reasonable measure. However, vaccine schedules is an area of legitimate debate, as witnessed by the fact that the U.S. and the EU have different pediatric vaccine schedules. Which vaccine schedule do you believe is best for kids? And Jennifer, maybe you've done more research on the EU schedule.
Well, that's a fascinating and important question, and I want to thank John for bringing that up. You know, if you look at the countries with the best outcomes and the healthiest children, places mostly in Scandinavia, Japan, for example, in Norway, until very recently, Norwegian children weren't given no vaccines until 3 months of age. So there's two really big differences with the Scandinavian schedule and the American. The first is that we do everything we can to really support women in their desire to breastfeed. And we know that breastfeeding is an incredibly important immune enhancer, that babies who are breastfed are much less likely to succumb to all sorts of diseases. And the other thing is that we, in Europe, we tend to do a delayed schedule so that we're not overloading the immune system in the first 2 months of life. So to answer John's question, I don't think there's a question that a European schedule is safer. What most people don't know is that the United States has one of the highest infant mortality rates of the industrialized world. Whether or not that's linked to vaccine is an open debate, but I do notice that we have this very aggressive, I would call it a bloated vaccine schedule in the first 2 months of life, whereas in Europe, most countries do not. And most countries in Europe do not give the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. Some don't give it at all, unless there's a legitimate risk.
If we know the infant mortality rate, I assume we know the reasons why children are dying.
It's a complex issue, right? Prematurity, SIDS is on the increase in countries that vaccinate heavily. I'd like to add a study that was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in February of 2015. It was a Norwegian study that looked at over 80,000 pregnancies and followed the children for an average of over 6 years. And they were looking at the autism rate in Norway. Half the kids got folate, and their autism rate was 1 in 1,000. And those who didn't get folate, it was 1 in 500. So the conclusion of the study is give folate during pregnancy. But what caught my attention was the rate. 1 in 1,000 in Norway at the same time the rate was 1 in 100 in the United States. I was like, this is impressive. What is going on? And as Jennifer just pointed out, they don't give the hepatitis B. They have a much higher breastfeeding rate and they have a slower schedule. That speaks to supporting the immune system and reducing toxicity.
All right, so you raise the issue of autism, which is always the place we tiptoe around carefully when discussing autism and vaccines in the same sentence. Here we are talking about them in the same sentence. What, for either of you, based on your research and your own clinical practice, do you believe to be a connection or not a connection between vaccines and autism?
So I'll qualify my statement by saying this. We need the huge study. We need to study a large sample of unvaccinated and compare them to selectively vaccinated, such as the vaccine-friendly plan, or fully vaccinated, such as the CDC schedule, and follow those kids for decades. Having said that, there is a small study showing no autism in a selectively vaccinated population published by Mumper a couple years ago. In my own practice, when I left my last practice in 2008, we implemented a strategy of vaccination that was outlined in the vaccine-friendly plan book, and we have over 1,000 children vaccinated that way with no new autism, no new autism spectrum. And the chance of that happening by random luck was 1 in 100,000, a p-value of 0.00001. We have 238 children in this study who are unvaccinated, and there was no new autism, no new autism spectrum. In the third group of the more vaccinated children, we had 15 cases out of almost 900, 15 children with autism or autism spectrum. So my experience has been by selectively vaccinating and making some individualized approaches. So when there's a high risk in the family history, parents with autistic children know this. If they have one autistic child, they do not vaccinate subsequent children, or almost always they don't. And the story almost every time is that subsequent children are fine. So it would appear, if you take both those case reports, which I have hundreds in my practice, and my experience that's been submitted for publication, the data which is in the appendices of this book, that there might indeed be a link. The mechanism, I believe, is probably toxins.
Toxins in what sense? You mean
the aluminum, for example, the multi-dose flu shot having mercury. There's formaldehyde in vaccines. There's polysorbate 80 and numerous other products that either are directly toxic or maybe toxic in the sense that they're triggering the immune system into an autoimmune type phenomenon.
What do you make of, and we've had guests who talked about this on the show, other scientific researchers who said from what they can determine, the way they extrapolate the findings is that these are children who might have ended up with autism anyway, but the vaccine enhanced it or accelerated it. What do you make of those findings?
Well, I really do believe that it's a complex puzzle. We have genetic vulnerability, so some families know that they're genetically more vulnerable. If you have the MTHFR defect, for example, and that's not the only defect to be worried about, but it does make it such that you don't get rid of toxins as easily as perhaps somebody else might. So there's a person who's a little more vulnerable to toxins. Now let's say their mother doesn't breastfeed or doesn't breastfeed very long. They're given acetaminophen. They're given a bunch of antibiotics very young, which we know disrupts the gut flora, which is also a factor. And then add to that an aggressive vaccine schedule. It may well be the vaccine that finally tips them over, as you said, where had that child been breastfed, had no other toxins, and didn't have the genetic risk factors, they probably would have been absolutely fine even with the aggressive schedule.
Paul Thomas is a pediatrician in the Portland area. Jennifer Margulis is an Ashland-based science journalist. They have co-written a book called The Vaccine-Friendly Plan, An Approach to Immunity and Health from Pregnancy Through Your Child's Teen Years. It's not so much about not vaccinating, but vaccinating on a different schedule. You can join us on the exchange with your perceptions, your questions, your comments at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The long discredited Lancet study, we're not going back and saying that there was anything to that, or are we? Jennifer, the eyes are on you. And
You're referring to a study that was done by a gastroenterologist named Andrew Wakefield.
Yes.
And, you know, we talk about that as the long, and sorry, it was done by him and 12 other scientists, I believe. You know, we talk about that as a discredited study, but if you actually go back and read it, it's a very interesting piece of work. And the only thing that that study concluded was that children who had been given the MMR vaccine were having huge amounts of gastrointestinal problems. So we're talking about diarrhea, constipation, that kind of thing, which Dr. Paul sees in his practice. And what they had found was that these children had antibodies against vaccine strain measles, if I'm getting my details right. So that study those results have actually been replicated several other times. And we finally, there was a definitive scientific study that was done recently showing that indeed this thing that parents keep commenting on, meaning that they go in for a round of vaccines and then their child gets explosive diarrhea running down their legs and it doesn't go away for months and months and months, is something that now has been shown scientifically, not just in the case studies, to be true. So, you know, people say that Andrew Wakefield, that name is radioactive. But I think what people don't know from the conversations in sort of the mainstream media is that Andrew Wakefield to this day continues to be speaking, to be kind of, he says that he's doing this because he cares about the children and he cares about families with autism. And one of the problems is that we haven't been listening to those families. We've kind of discredited them as if, like, if your child has autism and you noticed that it happened after vaccines, that makes you crazy. And what these parents, every single one that I've interviewed, and I've talked to hundreds of parents as a journalist, say is they say, this is my story. This is what happened to me. I'm trying to figure out why. And I just wanted to add on to one thing that Dr. Paul said, which is that we don't know. We don't know if it is the vaccines. We don't know what the mechanism is. We don't know why it's happening. We have some good hypotheses, but it has not been definitively established. But one thing that we do know, and we have all sorts of really important research that I think the FDA is finally going to pay attention to, is that if you give pediatric Tylenol, if you give acetaminophen before or after vaccines, and this is a standard recommendation, it's not a prescription drug, and doctors will often say, oh, if you're worried about a vaccine reaction, just give them some Tylenol. We know that that causes a huge disruption to your ability to metabolize and to deal with toxins. So the issue here is not necessarily toxic exposure. It's toxic exposure plus the body's ability to get rid of those toxins, right? Everyone is going to be exposed to all sorts of things. But if you are doing something that is deliberately, not deliberately, because people aren't doing it on purpose, but that is actually shutting off your body's innate ability to flush toxins, you're getting a perfect storm. So there's one researcher who I want to point out at Duke University Medical School named William Parker, and he has been working tirelessly. He's an expert in immunology, and he's been sort of conglomerating all of the research on acetaminophen. It's very, very damning. And it's very interesting to see that it might be something, one of the things we might need to do to make kids healthier in the United States, where we have a 1 in 45 rate of autism now, is to take pediatric Tylenol off the market.
I want to figure out again where the boundary lines are for the two of you. Are there any vaccines you are saying don't get ever?
In the book, we make a case for not needing to do the rotavirus if you live in the United States. It's just my own data shows that the kids who've gotten that vaccine are actually having more diarrhea, more vomiting, more ER visits for vomiting and diarrhea.
The rotavirus itself causes diarrhea.
Exactly.
And vomiting.
Yeah. Right. So the studies of rotavirus when they were initially done did show increase in intussusception. And that can actually be a fatal condition. Rotavirus in this country is a harmless vomiting diarrhea episode. Sure, the data will show lots of kids end up in the ER or in the hospital for intravenous fluids, but kids are not dying. In my practice, I've never had a problem with rotavirus in the 30 years I've been practicing. So that's one that I feel comfortable saying you can skip it. I'm not afraid of the vaccine, however. I'm not saying it's a bad vaccine. That's not what I mean at all. The other one that really needs more research is the HPV vaccine for teenagers. This is against cervical cancer for girls. Human papillomavirus and genital warts for boys or girls. And it looks to me that the safety data is just not adequate. The initial studies done by the companies themselves did not use a proper control. They used aluminum as their control group for the initial HPV-4. And then when they came out with the latest HPV-9 vaccine, they used the HPV-4 as their control. So it's never been properly controlled with a saline control group, for example. And it appears, as we can see from looking at studies around the world, other countries are no longer recommending that vaccine. We ought to be stepping back in this country and demanding better safety studies.
Is there another way to deliver vaccines? I mean, if part of the issue we're using some preservatives, for example, is that it's because we do multiple doses out of the same vial, would smaller vials be the answer?
We've moved to that in this country. Most vaccines are now single dose, and that's gotten rid of the mercury piece of the problem. We haven't found a solution for the adjuvant, which in the case of aluminum, I know there's a little bit of study looking at that, but we really don't have an adequate replacement.
Jennifer, do you have something to add to the HPV part of it?
I just wanted to say that I'm always interested in looking at what other countries are doing, and it's important for listeners to understand that Japan, which is often ahead of the United States on safety issues, has actually suspended the HPV program. So they found that so many young girls were having problems with this vaccine. It does seem to be a particularly problematic vaccine that they are no longer recommending it.
What were the problems that were developing from the HPV vaccination?
I don't know if you want to speak to that, Paul.
Well, it's causing a total immune shutdown in many children, and there have been deaths reported as well.
At what age? What age is it being administered?
It's now being recommended starting at age 9 or 11, mm-hmm. and then through the early 20s.
If you're not thinking in terms of that it's good at all, I mean, we're not talking about an age thing here. We're just talking about just maybe back off from this.
Yeah, the other problem with that vaccine is the initial studies only lasted 3.5 years. They were stopped when they were able to find a little bit of evidence that it decreased cervical dysplasia, but they never followed a long-term 10, 20, 30-year follow-up to see if it actually was reducing cervical cancer. I mean, there's over 100 strains of HPV. Granted, they picked the main ones that are thought to cause cancer, but sometimes with vaccines, when you target one strain, a different strain becomes more predominant in causing problems. And the only way you're going to know that is follow these patients, these children, young adults, for decades.
Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis are the co-authors of the Vaccine Friendly Plan. We'll come back and talk more with them for a few minutes. At the back of the hour, we will talk to Oregon State Forestry about the current state of affairs out in the fire zones. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back from the break and talk more about vaccines, followed by fire in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking with Paul Thomas, a Portland pediatrician, and Jennifer Margulis, a Rogue Valley-based science journalist, about the book they've co-written called The Vaccine Friendly Plan, Dr. Paul's Safe and Effective Approach to Immunity and Health from Pregnancy Through Your Child's Teen Years. This is not some whack job, self-published sort of thing, I want to point out. It is on Ballantine Books, which is a division of Penguin Random House, so being distributed nationally. You can meet them in person tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, or you can take part in the conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So just to restate again, we're not talking in most cases about avoiding vaccines. We're just talking about timing them differently. Is your plan then, Dr. Paul Thomas, pretty much similar to what the EU recommends?
Did you
just adopt the EU schedule, in essence?
No, we didn't adopt the EU schedule. What I did was use the principle of informed consent, and this is something that I think is being lost in America today. In fact, the Academy of Pediatrics just this last week has come out with a policy statement that's basically giving pediatricians permission and encouraging them to discharge patients who won't do all the vaccines, which I'm really saddened to read and see that that's the stand they're taking, because it sort of totally gets away from informed consent. Informed consent is where you give someone the pros, the cons, the alternatives, and one of them with vaccines should be not doing them. So what I did in my practice is I would give patients each vaccine that's about to be given. Here are the details, the pros and the cons, and the consequences of choosing to do it or not to do it, and let the parents decide. Obviously, you know, that's a huge discussion. And so it became apparent that this book was necessary, because it's just too long of a discussion to have in a typical half-hour visit. And so that's what we try to do with this book, is really lay it all out at each stage when you're going to go into your 2-week visit, your 2-month, 4-month, 6-month, 1-year visit, and right on through the teen years, cover those topics that are most common in that age group and the vaccine issue, which vaccines you're going to need to get.
I just like to say, you know, we have this idea that one size fits all with vaccines. And, you know, my children have been vaccinated against yellow fever because we spent a year in West Africa when they were little. And that was one of the vaccines that was required. And that's a smart vaccine to get if you're going to go live in Niger. That's not a vaccine that I would recommend for any other Americans unless they were traveling overseas. And I myself have been vaccinated against diseases that people have never even heard of because I've spent a lot of time working in West Africa. So it makes it's kind of an anathema to what we think is right. We should just get everyone in, vaccinate them on the same schedule. But what we say is that every family is an individual, and that we, you know, that one size doesn't fit all in medicine, and that we have to make judicious decisions based on our exposures. So a child who's going into daycare who hasn't been breastfed is probably going to need more vaccines, and it might be the smartest thing to follow the CDC schedule. A child who's going to be home the first year of life is being exclusively breastfed is not going to be have as many exposures to infectious disease. Our goal is to limit infectious disease. We do not want a recurrence of any of the infectious diseases that can hurt children, but to also make sure that we're protecting children's brains and protecting their immune systems.
So the life circumstances should come into play.
Absolutely.
It's a case-by-case basis, literally.
Right. And what your actual risks are. I would add one addendum to what you just said, Jennifer, and that is that child who's going into daycare does probably need a lot more protection, although they're probably not going to have sex or IV drug use in preschool or daycare. So we could probably wait on the hepatitis B till they're teenagers.
Fair enough.
One of the things that you point out in the book is you want medicine to stop doing a strictly by the numbers thing, but how else would it be done? I mean, we've all had our own experiences like, well, doctor, I don't feel so great. Well, your thyroid number's in the normal range. Well, what's normal for me though? You don't know because you don't do baseline. So, I mean, how do you be as specific as you can be with this patient and yet still look at the general range of outcomes that the rest of the population gets?
Yeah, I think it requires a real deeper level of analytical thinking when it comes to the patient that's in front of you. And, you know, just as Jennifer was saying, are they breastfed? Are they home? And if it's a first child, they don't have siblings bringing stuff from school. And what's going through the community? You know, back in 2012, we had a fairly large pertussis epidemic through the Northwest. And I was literally concerned that if I had, because I have some unvaxxed patients in my practice, I seem to be the magnet for them, and my peers think I don't vaccinate, which is not the case at all. But I was nervous for those unvaccinated children in my practice when we were seeing several cases. I had 20 cases in my practice that year alone of pertussis. That's more than I've ever had in my career. So it's usually a rare thing. So you look at what's going through the community and you respond appropriately.
Can there be the creation of designer vaccines? Has anybody ever discussed the possibility of having vaccines made by somebody other than the companies that put the aluminum and the thimerosal in there?
That's an interesting proposition.
Yeah, you know, it's not that you really want to have somebody with their own lab just sort of, you know, handing off on the street corner, you know, little bits of pathogens.
Yeah.
But
I think that some designer vaccines are actually in development right now. You know, there's some work coming out of a Stanford-educated scientist who is concerned about some of the vaccines contain tissue that was grown on aborted fetuses. And that's a big concern to religious people. So if we wanted to get people to do more vaccines, we would have to make sure that they were not done with aborted fetal tissue. So there are some vaccines like that in the pipeline. But I like your thinking, Jeffrey. Maybe in your next career?
I have to figure out what I'm going to do next. Sure. I want to come back to the acetaminophen connection. We're talking about Tylenol here, which is, you know, household pain reliever. Now, the reason we're using acetaminophen with kids is because we stopped using aspirin with kids, correct?
You bring up a very good point. So I trained exactly during that era in the late 1980s when aspirin was associated with Reye's syndrome. And we were taught and trained not to use aspirin in children, basically get it off the shelves, get it out of your house, and use acetaminophen. Back then, we were using the whole cell DPT vaccine. People who have children in their 20s and older remember that vaccine caused very high fevers, seizures, and deaths. It was a horrible vaccine. Japan got it out of their system 7 years before we moved in the United States. That's how we tend to be behind Japan. But in order to handle those high fevers and febrile seizures that were happening, we were instructing patients, give Tylenol right before your vaccine and then keep giving it after. And we had no idea back then that what we were recommending was probably doing the greatest harm of all, because you're injecting toxins and then you're giving them a substance, the acetaminophen, that blocks the ability to get rid of those toxins. It was a perfect storm.
You mentioned that there's a chapter in the book called Toxins, 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 and we've stayed fairly narrowly focused on the vaccines themselves. But the fact is that what you're talking here in general is an accumulation of things, an accumulation of vaccines and the stuff in them, in combination with the other stuff that comes into your body and your child's body from outside.
Correct. So when I have a prenatal, I sit with a new couple, mom's pregnant, and I point out to them, you're the world. Now, we all carry a body burden of toxins, and guys are just as toxic as the moms, but that body burden that the mom carries gets shunted to that fetus and to the developing brain. Then when you're born, game on, right? We start adding more toxins, whether it's in the food, the water, the air we breathe, or the medicines we're giving in the case of acetaminophen, or in the vaccines.
I want to thank Dr. Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is called The Vaccine Friendly Plan. It is really not so much about what to do, but when to do it. And they'll appear tonight at Bloomsbury Books at 7 o'clock in Ashland. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about vaccines.
Thank you for having us on.
Thanks for having us, Jeffrey.